the U.S. also has to confront the fact that regimes allied with America, such as Pakistan, Egypt, and Saudi Arabia, are undemocratic, corrupt, and repressive. Indeed, the misdoings and tyranny of these regimes strengthen the cause of the fundamentalists, who are able to tap deep veins of popular discontent. How do the regimes deal with this fundamentalist resistance? They subsidize various religious and educational programs administered by the fundamentalists that teach terrorism and hatred of America. By focusing the people's discontent against a foreign target, the United States, the regimes of Saudi Arabia, Egypt, and Pakistan hope to divert attention from their own failings. The United States must make it clear to its Muslim allies that this solution is unacceptable. If these regimes want American aid and American support, they must stop funding mosques and schools that promote terrorism and anti-Americanism. Moreover, they must take steps to reduce corruption, expand civil liberties, and enfranchise their people. In the long term, America's goal is a large and difficult one: to turn Muslim fundamentalists into classical liberals. This does not mean that we want them to stop being Muslims. It does mean, however, that we want them to practice their religion in the liberal way. Go to a Promise Keepers meeting in Washington, D.C., or another of America's big cities. You will see tens of thousands of men singing, praying, hugging, and pledging chastity to their wives. A remarkable sight. These people are mostly evangelical and fundamentalist Christians. They are apt to approach you with the greeting, "Let me tell you what Jesus Christ has meant to my life." They want you to accept Christ, but their appeal is not to force, but to consent. They do not say, "Accept Christ, or I am going to plunge a dagger into your chest." Even the fundamentalist Christians in the West are liberals. They are practicing Christianity in the liberal way. The task of transforming Muslim fundamentalists into classical liberals will not be an easy one to perform in the Islamic world, where there is no tradition of separating religion and government. We need not require that Islamic countries adopt America's strict form of separation, which prohibits any government involvement in religion. But it is indispensable that Muslim fundamentalists relinquish the use of force for the purpose of spreading Islam. They too should appeal to consent. If this seems like a ridiculous thing to ask of Muslims, let us remember that millions of Muslims are already living this way. These are, of course, the Muslim immigrants to Europe and the United States. They are following the teachings of their faith, but most of them understand that they must respect the equal rights of others. They have renounced the jihad of the sword and confined themselves to the jihad of the pen and the jihad of the heart. In general, the immigrants are showing the way for Islam to change in the same way that Christianity changed in order to survive and flourish in the modern world. Whether America can succeed in the mammoth enterprises of stopping terrorism and liberalizing the Islamic world depends a good deal on the people in the Middle East and a great deal on us. Fundamentalist Islam has now succeeded Soviet communism as the organizing theme of American foreign policy. Thus, our newest challenge comes from a very old adversary. The West has been battling Islam for more than 1,000 years. It is possible that this great battle has now been resumed, and that over time we will come to see the 70-year battle against communism as a short detour. But are we up to the challenge? There are some who think we are not. They believe that Americans are a divided people, not even a nation, but a collection of separate tribes. The multiculturalists actually proclaim this to be a good thing, and they strive to encourage people to affirm their differences. If, however, the multiculturalists are right in saying that all we have in common is our diversity, then it follows that we have nothing in common. This does not bode well for the national unity that is a prerequisite to fighting against a determined foe. If the ethnic group is the primary unit of allegiance, why should we make sacrifices for people who come from ethnic groups other than our own? Doesn't a nation require a loyalty that transcends ethnic particularity? Of course it does. And fortunately, America does command such a loyalty. The multiculturalists are simply wrong about America, and despite their best efforts to promote a politics of difference, Americans remain a united people with shared values and a common way of life. There are numerous surveys of national attitudes that confirm this, but it is most easily seen when Americans are abroad. Hang out at a Parisian cafe, for instance, and you can easily pick out the Americans. They dress the same way, eat the same food, listen to the same music, and laugh at the same jokes. However different their personalities, Americans who run into each other in remote places always become fast friends. And even the most jaded Americans who spend time in other countries typically return home with an intense feeling of relief and a newfound appreciation for the routine satisfactions of American life. It is easy to forget the cohesiveness of a free people in times of peace and prosperity. New York is an extreme example of the great pandemonium that results when countless individuals and groups pursue their diverse interests in the normal course of life. In a crisis, however, the national tribe comes together, and this is exactly what happened in New York and the rest of America following the terrorist attack. Suddenly, political, regional, and racial differences evaporated. Suddenly, Americans stood as one. This surprised many people, including many Americans, who did not realize that despite the forces that pull us in different directions, there is a deep national unity that holds us together. Unity, however, is not sufficient for the challenges ahead. America also needs the moral self-confidence to meet its adversary. This is the true lesson of Vietnam. Americans cannot succeed unless they are convinced that they are fighting on behalf of the good. There are some, as we have seen, who fear that America no longer stands for what is good. They allege that American freedom produces a licentious, degenerate society that is scarcely worth defending. We return, therefore, to the question of what America is all about and whether this country, in its dedication to the principle of freedom, subverts the higher principle of virtue. The central themes of American life can be seen in F. Scott Fitzgerald's novel, The Great Gatsby. The protagonist is typically American in that he has invented his own identity. James Gatz becomes J. Gatsby. On the surface, Gatsby is a great American success story. Yet Fitzgerald also portrays a darker side. Gatsby fabricates his credentials. He hangs out with shady figures, and his wealth has probably been acquired illegally. Moreover, Gatsby is a man of questionable judgment. He loves a woman, Daisy, who is vain and callous. He foolishly thinks that his great wealth can buy her affections and somehow erase the past. These are typical American illusions, and Gatsby pays a high price for them. He ends up dead in the swimming pool. Even so, Gatsby is Fitzgerald's hero. He is truly the great Gatsby, as he represents the magical self-transformation of the individual in a new kind of society. And in Fitzgerald's view, he is redeemed by the magnitude of his aspirations. There is something gorgeous about him, some heightened sensitivity to the promises of life, and an extraordinary gift for hope. Gatsby's life is a reminder of the astonishment and wonder with which the first Dutch sailors beheld the New World, a world that signals the fulfillment of the last and greatest of all human dreams. Fitzgerald's conclusion is that America still holds out that kind of promise. He implies, and I agree with him, that there is something unexpected, turbocharged, and exhilarating about living in such a society. It is simply more fun than living elsewhere. So what about virtue? The fundamental difference between the society that the Islamic fundamentalists want and the society that Americans have is that the Islamic activists seek a country where the life of the citizens is directed by others, while Americans live in a nation where the life of the citizens is largely self-directed. The central goal of American freedom is self-reliance. The individual is placed in the driver's seat of his own life. The Islamic fundamentalists presume the moral superiority of the externally directed life on the grounds that it is aimed at virtue. The self-directed life, however, also seeks virtue. Virtue realized not through external command, but, as it were, from within. The real question is, which type of society is more successful in achieving the goal of virtue?